they've got three major economic zones around Beijing, around Shanghai, and around Hong Kong and Guangzhou, which then have to connect to the world, and they connect to the world across what they describe as the Near Seas, the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, the East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea. And immediately on the other side of those seas are American allies and the American Navy, right? The American Navy is in those seas.
Mm-hmm.
And so in naval circles, people talk a lot about the first island chain, but I try to think about it from their perspective. This is this kind of wall of American power right on the other side of these waters on which their trade is so fundamentally dependent.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Hello, I'm Tyler Pitroff. Welcome to Preble Hall. Today our guest is Dr. Bruce Jones. He's a former VP of the Brookings Institution, where he now directs the Project on International Order and Strategy of the Foreign Policy Program. He's lived all over the world, Asia, Africa, Europe, and served with the UN in operations in Kosovo and the Middle East. He's also been a senior advisor to the World Bank and lectured or been a non-resident fellow at Princeton, Stanford, Yale, and NYU, and as of today at the United States Naval Academy. He has documented the changing dynamics of world power in several previous books about international affairs, and he joins us today to talk about his most recent book, To Rule the Waves, How Control of the World's Oceans Shapes the Fate of the Superpowers. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So it's been a very interesting journey to read this book for a couple of different reasons that I imagine probably all immediately pop into your mind, from the style of the book, the places you take us in the book, the different topics you're covering. I think, though, where I'd like to start talking about it would actually be at the very end. You conclude the book by writing that once oceans were the boundary of our existence, now they are the front lines of the new rivalries that will shape the 21st century. All but the tiniest fraction of humankind resides on land, works on land, interacts with other humans primarily on land. It is entirely possible to live a rich life and never once set foot in the world's oceans. A substantial portion of humanity lives their entire existence without ever setting eyes on them. And yet the seas shape the world around us. It is on the oceans that the greatest struggles of our day, for military power, for economic dominance, over our changing climate, are playing out. Our security, our prosperity, and our environment hang in the balance. What inspired you to write a book where your topic is so perhaps all-encompassing as that? Where should we start with that?
It was funny. I was spending my time at Brookings thinking about geopolitical rivalry, thinking about globalization. I'd spent some time, I'd written a book about global energy flows. I'd spent some time thinking about the Arctic. I'd done some work on climate change. And I realized at a certain point in time that I kept on coming back to the oceans, obviously in the Arctic, importantly in the science of climate change. I'd begun to understand how critical sea-based flows were to globalization. And it was at the beginning of the tensions between ourselves and the Chinese really starting to play out in the waters of the Western Pacific. And so I wanted to write a book that tried to explain where we were in these big debates in geopolitics and globalization and climate change. And it occurred to me that it might be interesting and instructive to step away from the land and to look at the world through the prism of the oceans. And I describe that it's not a book about the oceans, it's a book set on the oceans. The oceans are sort of a backdrop to these issues playing out around us. I will say that the more I wrote, the more I realized quite how profound is the role that the oceans are playing in the way these issues are being articulated, and how vast are the stakes, whether it's in geopolitical rivalry, in globalization, in energy flows, in data flows, in climate change. So the book kind of grew in scope as I wrote. and I was struck by this phenomenon. I spent most of my life living on the water. My father was a diplomat. We lived only in coastal cities. At the end of the book, I write about having, I think, age 10, having gone to what must have been the first offshore oil platform in West Africa with my father. Hmm. So the seas had been there through my life. I spent part of my childhood in Denmark. I was aware of Maersk as a company growing up. And then being in Washington and close by to Annapolis and the history and the role of the Navy being very present. But I was increasingly aware of how little the issues of the ocean, the issues of sea power are present in our national debates, are present in our own understandings of the world. And I write in the book about this kind of modern sea blindness that we've taken on. So again, it was partly trying to understand the world and partly trying to explain the world that led me to this project.
So you end up having, as you said, it sort of ballooned as you wrote, right? You end up having four major parts to that book. And while you give four almost bullet points in the introduction, globalization, the confrontation with China, communications, and of course, energy, the parts don't explicitly stick to that. That tends to be the themes of the book. But that's not all-encompassing. It's not containerized that way, if you'll pardon the expression, which we'll get into in a couple of minutes. Before we do any of that, though, I have to ask, which part of that ended up being the genesis of the book? Where did you start?
So as I say in the prelude, I actually started in the middle of the Amazonian rainforest, which I know sounds like a completely bizarre way to start a book, but all these ideas were swirling around in my head, but they weren't formed. And then I went with my family to the Amazon. We were on a sort of scientific holiday, so to speak, with one of the fathers of modern biodiversity science, and went to a very important research camp in the Amazon, in the rainforest. But while there, went out onto the Amazon itself. Here we are 1,000 miles away from the nearest ocean. And what do I see steaming up the river but a container ship with containers from Maersk, which I recognized from my childhood. And it was just this kind of crystallization for me of how consequential sea-based trade was for globalization, which was the backbone of the phenomenon of the rising powers, which was the most important dynamic in globalization, in geopolitics. And so it sort of just all came together at that moment, a realization that by looking at this through the prism of the seas, I was going to be simultaneously going to be able to understand the nature of modern globalization and the nature of modern geopolitics. The issues of energy and climate came later as I began to understand how important they were, and I read more about them, began to understand how consequential the oceans have been for regulating climate change, so to speak, and where we are now. But it was really that interplay between globalization and geopolitics, which is where the book started.
Gotcha. So that had some influence, obviously, on the way the book ends up being structured as a result of that. You end up starting with that geopolitical setting of the stage. And, you know, a lot of books like this, of course, need historical background. So you give us some of that with the British Empire and then passing the baton, so to speak, to the American dominance of the world seas after World War II. And then you get to what is clearly what you're expecting a lot of people to come to this book for, which is the seemingly inexorable approach of this confrontation with China. And you take this tack where you're trying to show us, and forgive me for putting words into your mouth, but you're trying to show us almost how this is hypocrisy, but also, yeah, it's happening. China and the United States are so closely, everybody knows there's such a large trading arrangement going on between the U.S. and China, if they don't know specifically the details. But then also, why would we see China as an adversary, and why would China see us as an adversary? So is that one then resulting from that? Is that one of your main tasks? Are you trying to explain that? Is that just showing how things are? I apologize for the vague terms of the question.
No, it's
a difficult
fine.
Thing
it's,
to get your head around, and hence the structure of the book, I think.
Yeah, so as you allude to, that I do a brief, it's not a brief chapter, but I briefly cover the history. It's 500 years of history of sea power in 14,000 words, making this point, which I think we sort of forgot during the Cold War, right, when naval power still mattered, but sort of receded to kind of secondary position behind nuclear strategy and air power and our land presence in Europe. We forget that it is true that since the mid-1500s, no state, no empire, no country has held the pole position in international politics, has been the leader of the international order without simultaneously fielding the world's dominant navy. That's true from the time the Portuguese found their way into the Asian waters in the mid-1500s, to be true since. Then, if we look in the post-Cold War period, in the post-World War II period, this huge expansion of containerized trade and a huge expansion of sea-based trade, which we'll come to, the entry of China into that trade, leads to this hypothesis, which has really been dominant over the last couple of decades, that China's dependence on globalization for the growth of its own economy and our commingling, our codependence on the global economy, should serve as a bulwark against geopolitical tensions. But what it relies on is a Chinese willingness to accede to a conceptualization of the world where it's our navy that secures the flow of that trade. Since the end of the Second World War, we've had that role, securing the freedom of trade, securing the freedom of flow of energy. We use the kind of highly technical term in my mind now, freedom of navigation operations, free and open Indo-Pacific. These are kind of technical terms. What we're really talking about is using naval power to protect commerce. And they've profited from that. But they're also extraordinarily vulnerable to it. And what I see in the evolution of Chinese strategic thinking, and Chinese naval thinking in particular over the last several decades, is an increasing degree of discomfort with the degree to which they are vulnerable to our role in securing the flows that are vital for their economy. And so you see this evolution of Chinese naval strategy and of Chinese overarching strategy to want to be able to play its own role in securing those flows. That could lead us to a point of condominium. We could say, you know, we have an interest in the flow of trade, they have an interest in the flow of trade, we could co-protect that, we don't have to be at loggerheads. But as I write in the book, all that would have to happen is we'd have to trust them and they'd have to trust us. Well, guess what? We don't trust them and they don't trust us. And we're back into the classic dynamics of great power rivalry as a consequence.
I like how you use the term vulnerability there. I don't think there could be anything simultaneously more understated and critical than using the term vulnerability for just the entirety of the international system, of the globalized supply system, which we'll, again, talk more about in a few minutes, I suppose. But that's a good point to transition a little bit to talking about, okay, so you've said there is simultaneously this vulnerability in the system, this codependence in the system, but also as a result, this distrust inherent in the system. And the way you set about proving that is, I think, the most striking feature of the book, which is how you write every part of it in every chapter, which is a third to half of each chapter, is something of an on-site assignment for you, for lack of a better way of putting it. It strikes me as an on-assignment piece, almost from a journalist, but in all the good ways. Telling a story about a location, the Amazon, as you said, is what you start with. On board enormous container ships when it comes to going to Shanghai or going to Port Elizabeth in New York, or I suppose it's New Jersey. Showing these places to the reader and explaining how things actually work is clearly one of the main tasks you assign yourself in the pursuit of explaining all of this. Why do you think that's important? Because clearly it is important to you, otherwise you wouldn't do it, right?
Well, first of all, it's a lot more fun to write that way than to write in the traditional social science voice.
I would agree with that.
But much more importantly than that, I did not want this to be a book for a specialist audience. I wanted a specialist audience to be able to read it and think, oh, yeah, he's read the right stuff. He knows what he's talking about. It's thoroughly footnoted. I read all the material, et cetera. And a lot of these are issues I've written about in other more social science tones of voices. But I wanted this to be a book for a wider audience. I wanted to be able to speak to people who could see that things were changing around them. And we hear about China and China militarization and Chinese nuclear weapons and submarines, and we hear about all this stuff. We have this big debate about free trade where, you know, there's big changes in the nature of American energy market. We hear about climate change. But I don't think social scientists are doing a good job talking to the broader public if we write books and write articles that are sort of clogged up with citations to IMF reports and, you know, naval planning documents, right? And we need to be able to tell stories. We need to be able to illustrate.
Absolutely.
And frankly, I'm somebody who learns by seeing. You know, if I can see a place, it makes it easier to understand the dynamics. And so my job required me to travel, and I simply took a notebook. And when I was in Shanghai, I made arrangements to go to the container port. When I was, you know, at meetings with Indo-PACOM, I, you know, made arrangements to go out and inspect and sort of see around a ballistic missile destroyer. I went up to the port of New York with the Coast Guard and sailed around with them and went inside the what they call a container examination station, where you can really see how, I mean, literally everything that we consume in this country comes into our ports via bulk shipping and containerized shipping. So I wanted to educate myself and to illuminate and illustrate to a wider audience the nature of our economy, the nature of our security, the nature of our environment, and how dependent they all are on the oceans.
My enthusiastic gesturing at the beginning of your response is because I'm also very much someone who needs to see what's being discussed, or at least have a very effective verbal picture of it painted for me. So I found that highly effective and quite a page turner, quite frankly.
Thank you.
But the other thing that I was getting at by asking that is, as you've just demonstrated, that's such a spread of locations and things and jobs and just objects. Who does understand all of this stuff academically without having it explicitly described for them in that way or seeing it themselves? It's difficult for any one person, aside from someone like yourself, who's able to travel to see these things, to really know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To really understand what they're being told when they say, oh yeah, everything comes in through the ports. No, you don't understand. Like, you need to go see the gamma radiation scanner in Port Elizabeth that everything has to drive through to perhaps start understanding why we've got such a traffic jam at certain ports like, say, L.A.
Right. Yeah, I have to say it was eye-opening for me as well. You understand these things in social science terms. I knew the volume of trade that moved. I knew that 85% of world trade moved by sea, but that's a kind of a data point. And then to see the tomatoes, the rice, the pork products, the boots, the clothes, the stereo equipment, the health supplies, just everything that we consume arrayed there in the container examination room in Newark, New Jersey, was eye-opening to me. As it was to go to the container port of Shanghai, in south of Shanghai, Yangshan Container Port, which last year processed 42 million container movements. By comparison, Los Angeles did 8 million. That's six times larger than the Port of New York. Just to feel, not to understand, but to feel the sheer size of China's role in global trade. And I wanted to try to convey that to the readers by describing those site visits, as you call them, to illuminate, not just to explain.
It's almost like a travel book in that way.
Hopefully a little better research, but yes,
true
but
enough,
it has,
but
that,
perhaps I should
has
say,
that feeling.
Perhaps I should say also a good thing in this era of the pandemic, maybe thinking about tailing off a little bit when people are very enthusiastic about, such as myself, very enthusiastic about getting out to travel again and sort of living vicariously through
that. I was lucky because I did most of the site visits. I did my last site visit to the USS John Paul Jones, ported at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu. And I left Honolulu on the 28th of February and flew back of 2020 and flew back to the United States, mainland United States. And about 6 days later, everything started closing down in Hawaii and in Washington.
It's funny how that works out sometimes.
I just got it in under the wire. The one trip that I was going to do was to the Bay of Bengal. I was going to go out to Port Blair, the Indian Naval Station in the Bay of Bengal, because I wanted to end the book the same way I began the book. I started the book in the Arctic, where you see strategic questions, commercial questions, energy questions, and climate change all operating in the same locale. And that's happening as well in the Bay of Bengal. And I wanted to go there. So I had to go there by Zoom. I had to talk to people I knew who are out there and do it by Zoom, which isn't quite as good. But at least I had some friends who live there and could sort of use their eyes to see what's going on in the Bay of Bengal, which is really the front lines for the India-China naval rivalry, but also being transformed by the dynamics of climate change, by sea level rise, storm surges, et cetera, in very dramatic ways. And so I wanted that bookending effect. But as in the end, I had to do it by Zoom. But everything else I snuck in just under the wire.
So there are a few things I'd like to touch on a little bit more specifically that you give a lot of time to, which I think are brilliant because they're just not thought about or talked about, despite how critical they are to all of your points, but also to the functioning of the everyday world, as we're increasingly seeing as we approach the holidays this year and everyone goes to try and buy gifts and discovers that it's not so easy as it usually is. So, of course, by that I'm alluding to that containerization word right. that we've thrown around. And I'm going to perhaps start this by saying something that very much grabbed me in the talk you gave over at Nimitz Library at the Naval Academy earlier today was, I believe you mentioned, in comparing the amount of cargo that a cargo ship could carry 100 years ago as opposed to today, we're looking at something in the neighborhood of a 17,000% increase in the amount of cargo that a single vessel can carry.
Right. And in the efficiency of those costs.
And the frequency, yes. Yeah. And of course, also the method by which, again, containerization, that this is actually done and that facilitates that happening. Can you explain just what has happened to shipping in the last half century?
It's really striking to me. So your listeners may well be aware that the first container ships were sailed out of the port of Newark. So there's another sort of nice connection back. It was an American trucking executive, McLean, who was frustrated by delays in getting his truck's goods offloaded from the truck and sitting around on a port for days at a time, and then loaded onto ships. And he got frustrated by all this. He said, well, what if I could just drive my truck onto this ship? And he basically modified his trucks and a ship to be able to do that. And, you know, long story short, invented containerized shipping. Yeah, there had been efforts to try that kind of thing before, and most importantly by the U.S. Army, actually, during the Second World War, standardized boxes, what were called Connex boxes, containerized boxes for shipping of goods. But McLean really took it to the next level, connecting trucking to shipping. And there's a superb book written about this called The Box, which describes this early history of containerization. It starts to allow shipping to move more goods at the same time more quickly. That starts off as an East Coast of the United States trade, quickly expands to a transatlantic trade. It's the United States and it's Europe sending goods back and forth. What then happens is we fight a war in Korea, and we have to create a logistics bridge to Korea. And then we fight a war in Vietnam. We have to create another logistics bridge to Vietnam. And the use of containers in that process, the building up of ports that can accommodate large-scale flows of containerization, starts to enable the entry of those, what we call at the time the Asian Tigers, Korea, Singapore, et cetera, as well as Japan, into broader patterns of globalization, and they start to grow. And what's striking to me in doing the research in this is there's a kind of precise one-to-one relationship between the size of bulk shipping and the growth in the global economy. It's a precise one-to-one relationship. The more stuff that can be put on a ship, the more stuff that can move through global trade systems, and those end up being 85% of all global trade. Right? Global trade is a function of the flow of goods by sea, mostly in bulk shipping, containerized shipping. Peter Maersk, who founded what is now the largest shipping company in the world, the Maersk Company, whose containers were sailing up the Amazon when I started the project, he started off as a merchant in the Baltic trade. The ship that he sailed at the time carried roughly the equivalent of about 20 containers in modern terms. And he operated that ship with a crew of 27 people. When I sailed on the Maersk Madrid, it had the equivalent of 20,500 containers on board and sailed with a crew of 24. And that's where I get the number 17,000% increase in the efficiency of trade. So it's just this fantastic explosion in the scale of trade, prompted in part by the Suez Crisis, prompted in part by the creation of these kind of logistical bridges to Asia during the Korean and Vietnamese wars, but nonetheless creating vast opportunities for trade. And that really is the modern story of globalization, is this expansion of trade. And as I describe in the book, again, using a site visit as you describe it, spent a lot of time with an entrepreneur in Hong Kong whose father created what eventually became the largest shipping company in Asia. Started in Shanghai, but then fled to Hong Kong with the communist takeover of China. And eventually turns Hong Kong into one of the largest container ports in the world, with all the sophisticated financial and legal and other kind of mm-hmm. infrastructure that goes along with that. A critical outpost of the West in Asia until 2000 comes along and it reverts to China. And it's this massive shot in the arm, this massive sort of rocket boost to the Chinese economy just as China's entered the WTO. And it's containerized shipping and bulk shipping that really is what enables China to be the low-cost producer to globalization. We can buy goods that are produced in China and they're brought to American ports or to European ports. And the cost of that is so trivial. The transportation cost is so trivial because of the scale and the efficiency of bulk shipping that there is no transportation barrier to them entering the market. And it's what enables China to fill this huge role in modern trade that it still plays to this day.
And of course, the added twist to that is when shipping costs become so incredibly low like that, and also you integrate all of these new powerful manufacturing centers, again, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Japan, you end up having a much more global supply chain, which is the terminology they use nowadays. The terminology we use nowadays.
Right, and it's more than that. It's a just-in-time global supply chain. It's
right.
Not just that goods are produced in China and Vietnam and then brought here. It's that parts of goods are produced all over the place and then stitched together in other locations and then ferried across the world's oceans to our ports. And I describe, you know, the iPhone or Nutella. You would think Nutella was produced by, you know, one company with two products. No, there are about 17 countries' goods that go into producing Nutella, and about 40 countries whose goods go into producing an iPhone, right? And all of this is happening by way of bulk shipping. And so our entire economy, European, international, our entire economy, American, is a just-in-time global supply trade system, very vulnerable to disruption, unfortunately.
Though we have obviously benefited from that.
Vastly benefited from it, and not benefited from it, right? And I described the two sides of that coin in the book. There has been this phenomenon of sort of a negative impact on the American middle class, the shift of wealth to Asian middle class, the loss of manufacturing, the loss of jobs in that sector. By the estimates that I've read, that's roughly three times overcompensated for by the growth in jobs in the service sector and the financial sector. 50% of all profits in the American economy come out of the financial and the services sector now. We have profited from this far more than we have lost from it. But that has not been a geographically evenly distributed phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
The major port cities tied into globalization, tied into the flow of finance, have hugely profited. The inland parts of the country, less so, even though, you know, the inland port system brings goods to people. They have not profited in the same way from the services industry, from the financial industries. And so globalization, I argue at the end of the book, has been quite bad for us politically, while at the same time being extremely good for us economically. And of course, we're grappling with that in modern American politics.
To an extent, then, beyond the domestic political implications, that brings us a little bit full circle back to China, of course. Because while we have obviously benefited, at least in some sectors immensely, from this globalization of everything, really, so has China, so has India, so has Japan, so has Europe, so has everyone else, to an extent. And of course, as you said earlier, that has implications, because who's protecting that trade?
Right. We who's are. Setting the terms?
Yeah.
We protect the trade and we are therefore in a very powerful, we protect the trade and we finance the trade and we're therefore in a very powerful position to set the terms of the trade. And China has reached a point in my mind where it's no longer content to be on the wrong side of that equation.
So to spin the table and sit down on the other side then from the Chinese perspective, which you, I think, do very effectively in the book, what do the Chinese see as their position here? What are their options? What do they feel they need to do?
Right.
Or is there anything they feel they need to do?
Yeah, so in this part of the book, when I sort of transition to Chinese strategy, I start inside Zhonghanai Palace, which is the kind of the center of decision-making in Beijing, and it's striking when you think about it. They're 150 miles from their nearest coastline, protected by these high walls. It's a very kind of internal, compound, protected feeling place, and I put myself in their shoes and think about their leadership sort of looking out from Beijing. And of course, what they see is they've got three major economic zones around Beijing, around Shanghai, and around Hong Kong and Guangzhou, which then have to connect to the world. And they connect to the world across what they describe as the Near Seas, the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, the East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea. And immediately on the other side of those seas are American allies and the American Navy, right? The American Navy's in those seas.
Mm-hmm.
And so in naval circles, people talk a lot about the first island chain, but I try to think about it from their perspective. This is this kind of wall of American power right on the other side of these waters on which their trade is so fundamentally dependent. And I do think that that kind of China's first re-entry into the seas in the 1990s and the 2000s partly about their kind of resource grabs in the South China Sea, but I think much more fundamentally is about reducing their vulnerability to our naval power as a source of security of that trade, a position of deep discomfort for any rising power to be dependent on another country's power to secure the flow of their own trade. And so that does strike me as sort of deep in their strategy. As I think it is fair to say, it's deep in their psyche that their first experience goes back to the history section, that their first experience of the West came when the English East India Company and the Royal Navy sort of punched through their very limited defenses and compelled them to sign the Treaty of Nanking and the Treaty of Bogue and to foster quote-unquote free trade on them, which basically meant that we were going to dump lots of opium into their economy, mm-hmm. and with giant consequence for their society. This is an economy and a society that was kind of corrosively corrupt and sort of eroding from within anyway. It shouldn't have taken three British frigates to collapse the Chinese Empire, and that was all it took. So it gives you a sense of how corroded it was. Nonetheless, in Chinese elite memory, the fact of British naval power forcing them to a very unequal set of trade arrangements is very live. And when we talk about the role of the Navy in securing free trade, the history that harkens back to is very different than the one that we think of in those terms. And it's striking me to look back at those treaties and to realize that the very terms of trade that we currently operate, the kind of legal articles of the WTO, trace very directly their roots back to those treaties and to British naval power. And so for the Chinese to kind of to escape that system, I think is an overarching mm-hmm. Impulse. There are other features of Chinese ambition, but at core, it seems to me, it really is to escape that system where they are operating within terms of trade that have been dictated by the West and secured by the West and financed by the West.
You used two pretty effective analogies in service to that. Of course, one is the East Germany analogy of the West Pacific is the East Germany of, or just, I guess, the Germany of the modern era. But I think the more effective one that you give, of course, is the comparison of the Suez Canal to the Singapore Strait, because it's easily as critical a waterway, of course, the Singapore Strait being through what you would know in World War II terms, coming from a little bit more of what I am a historian of, the Malay Barrier,
right,
of that block of land that you have to pass through to go from the Western Pacific, the East China, or the South China Sea, excuse me, into the Indian Ocean.
Right.
And to get really anywhere. And that, of course, is one small area of the world, which is perhaps a little bit less stringently controlled than the United States and its defensive allies. And as a result, has started receiving the lion's share, or if not the lion's share, but a considerable amount of attention from China. That's also a place where you circle back at one point in the book, right?
Yeah, it was actually the start of part one of the book, before I do the history, before I go to the Arctic, even in the kind of prelude, I go to southern Malaysia, to the southern point of the Malay Barrier, as you describe it, and the port of Tanjung Pelepas, which is the Malaysian equivalent to the port of Singapore. It's just across the river.
And if I can also interject, I'm sorry, this also, at least from my perspective, sheds a little bit more information on, if you will recall, the disappearance of MH370 a few years ago. and the discovery that, oh, well, actually all of the countries in this little corner of the world have very sophisticated military radars that are capable of detecting objects much more effectively than had previously been disclosed. And that's because this is the degree of commercialization, of traffic, of activity that's going on.
Right.
It's insanely busy.
It's insanely busy. I sailed the Singapore Strait on the Madrid Maersk, and I describe it as like trying to drive through New York and, you know, rush hour traffic. Like, cars honking, I mean, ships honking and people blaring at you over the radio, and Chinese fishing vessel captains and oil freighter captains, everybody barking at each other over the radio, and hundreds of ships in this clogged strait. And then, of course, you go into the Malacca Strait, which is undergoverned and narrow and vulnerable, and has been the source of piracy. I bring in the way piracy surged alongside the growth in global shipping. That has a consequence too. It's what first pulls China out of the near seas and into the farther seas is the counter-piracy trade. First, they're part of the coalition to deal with piracy in the Malacca Straits. But then going farther into the Indian Ocean.
Should sound familiar to U.S. historians.
Indeed. And I make this point in the book that, you know, as post-independence, the Navy really came out of the piracy attacks on American trade in the Atlantic, and we forge a Navy and a Marines to go off and fight the Barbary pirates. It's a protection of trade function. It doesn't stay there.
Yeah.
And I think in the same way, China's entry into the far seas as a counter-piracy function hasn't stayed there either. It's become a more expansive ambition. But absolutely, the Singapore Strait is now 50% of the world trade flows through the Singapore Strait. It is to the modern period what the Suez Canal was to the 1900s and the early 20th century. And in Malaysia, it's very striking, sort of going back to the port of Tanjung Pelepas, built up very rapidly. Now it's the 18th largest port in the world. And I describe this vast complex of apartment buildings, which is between the two ports, which are largely empty, but all financed and constructed by a major Chinese developer, basically as what I call a sort of anticipatory engineering, right? This is a huge complex available to China. If it is the case that the situation deteriorates further, and if Malaysia more fully flips away from the West and towards the Chinese sort of geopolitical zone, they have the infrastructure in place to flood in people, to control that port, and to give themselves a major port on the Straits of on the Singapore Strait and the Strait of Malacca, versus being beholden to Singapore, which, you know, the American Navy and the British Navy still have a hold on. So it was very striking to me to see the scale of their sort of preemptive investment in the Singapore Strait. I wish that we were capable of quite such ambitious preemptive investments in various parts of the world.
That investment, of course, may look intelligent right now, but may not, depending on what happens with the environment. And that is the final important piece of your book that may seem surprising if somebody were to just kind of flip open the book in a bookstore to say, to the last part, and say, wait, why are we talking about sea level rise? Or the history of the detection of sea level rise? I just like to touch on that a little bit, and especially its origins the United States Navy.
Right. So there were kind of two things that are real interesting to this, and or maybe three, and I'll touch on them briefly. So in writing the history of British naval power in the first part of the book, I was reminded of the important role of the major scientific expeditions that the Royal Navy mounted, famously, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sailing of the HMS Beagle,
disappearance of the Franklin expedition.
All of these things that we know about from our study of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I was completely unaware that long before the Beagle, by far and away the largest ocean-going scientific expedition was not British. It was mounted by the U.S. Navy. It was the U.S. Exploring Expedition, the USXX. Collected a lot of what became the foundation of the Smithsonian, did the first work to chart what we now call the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic. A phenomenally important scientific expedition mounted in the early days of U.S. Naval exploration. And it was just a kind of a striking fact to me to see how sort of naval science and naval ambition was there at the beginning of American internationalism, right? We then sort of sail off to Asia. I didn't know starting this book, that people talk about our long war in Afghanistan and our our longest deployment ever in the Korean Peninsula. Well, no, our longest military deployment ever was on the Yangtze River in Shanghai with the U.S. Asiatic station, a naval station, ported out of Hong Kong and then operating on Shanghai. We were in, on the Yangtze River out of Shanghai for almost 100 years. Maintaining an American naval posture in Asia. We were part of putting down the, we were part of the Second Opium War. We were part of the multi-empire brigade that put down, and empire is the right word in that period of time, multi-empire brigade that put down the Boxer Rebellion. We have this kind of extraordinarily long history at sea that we sometimes forget. But that early science, that early impulse to science led then to the founding of oceanographic institutes in the United States. And then all of that gets a huge surcharge at the beginning of the Second World War, when it becomes apparent we're going to be fighting this war partly at sea, and there's this huge investment in the science of oceanography by the Office of Naval Research, and a whole series of experiments that are done by ONR, both during World War II and then the immediate aftermath of World War II, as we're testing nuclear weapons at sea. And a great deal of what we know now about climate change can be traced directly back to those experiments. Why? Because the oceans are vastly the great carbon sink of the modern system. 90% of all of the excess carbon produced by the burning of oil and gas over the last 70 years has been absorbed by the oceans. And so if we think about the putting carbon into the atmosphere by the burning of oil and gas, the absorption of that excess heat and excess carbon by the oceans has been a hugely important dynamic that has slowed the impact in terms of a changing climate. But it has also changed the chemistry of the oceans over time. And what we're watching now is a change in the chemistry and a rise in temperature of the oceans, which are going to have a series of impacts. I want to say one more thing about the climate impacts, but before I do, I don't want to skip over this other piece of the story, which is the role of the Office of Naval Research and the Navy itself, not only driving a lot of the science behind climate change, but also driving a lot of the engineering that leads to what is now the huge modern phenomenon of offshore energy exploration and drilling. 80% of the world's oil and 50% of the world's gas is either found at sea or moves by sea to final destination. We think of energy, modern energy, oil and gas, we still think of derricks in the Saudi desert and drills in the Texas desert. Of course, we think about pipelines. Of course, we know about oil tankers. But the oceans play a hugely more important role than we commonly think about in the production and the flow of modern energy. Almost all of the engineering that has made that possible came out of a series of experiments that linked the American Navy and American private sector engineering firms, often off the coast of Hawaii, sometimes in the Gulf of Mexico. It is a phenomenal story of American ingenuity and of American engineering. At a time when we tend to talk about, oh, America can't do this and America can't do that, we should be noticing that the United States is vastly the source of engineering prowess and know-how in the maritime space, deep sea offshore drilling. It happens everywhere now. The Baltic Sea, the Barents Sea, the South China Sea, it happens everywhere. But it's American engineering at its core, and American firms are central to it. We should be celebrating that and building on that. And I suggest in the book, given sea level rise, that maritime engineering may be as consequential in the next 20 to 30 years as the kind of infrastructure spending that the Chinese are doing through Belt and Road Initiative are now. So it's something we should be celebrating and building on. Last point here is that sea level rise plays out very differently in different geographies, playing out very differently in the Atlantic than in the Arctic, than in the South China Sea, than in the Bay of Bengal.
We're not quite all in the same boat together.
We're not quite all in the same boat, and we always, people always talk about climate change as this issue that's going to drive us all together. And sure, if we look out to the kind of very dramatic consequences that could come in the worst case scenarios 150 years from now and et cetera, well, that may be true. But in the shorter term, in the next 20 to 30 years, the way this is going to play out, the way the sea levels are going to change and the way that will impact with storm surges, et cetera, play out very differently, and I think are likely to drive more competition than cooperation, as well as opportunity for competition in the economic and the engineering space. That was a very long-winded answer to your question.
Well, I've fully answered the question, which, of course, is the most important part. I wish we had more time, but unfortunately, I have to let Dr. Jones attend to his business. So once again, his book is titled To Rule the Waves, How Control of the World's Oceans Shapes the Fate of the Superpowers, available everywhere, including on my desk in front of me here.
So, thanks for having
me here. Thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to see you again soon.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.